Part 1. Feet and Legs. Chapter 2. Grounded. A little over 40 miles northwest of Aleppo, in northern Syria, set high above a valley, there lie the remains of a gateway to heaven, an ancient temple, the meeting place of the heavenly and earthly planes. A colossal carved lion, its teeth and claws bared, guards the approach. Surrounded by walls of black basalt, its floor paved with pale flagstones, the temple is the dwelling place of a long-lost deity, worshipped by the Syro-Hittites, close cultural cousins of the ancient Israelites and Judahites. Partially destroyed in the 8th century BCE and devastated again in a Turkish airstrike in 2018, this temple at Ayn Dara is the closest we can come to the temple that stood in Jerusalem at the same time. Its structure and iconography map so precisely onto the biblical description of Solomon's temple, it's as though they shared the same divine blueprint. When I visited the temple in 2010, shortly before the war in Syria began, wild summer flowers dotted the grass at the temple's edges, dappling the feet of guardian beings and lions lining the base of its now broken walls. I took off my shoes and walked barefoot up the warm, shallow steps to the entrance of the temple's outer courtyard. And then I saw them. Two giant footprints, each about a metre in length, carved into the limestone threshold. Neatly paired, they were pointing into the temple. The toes and balls of each footprint were softly, deeply rounded, as though they'd been pressed firmly into wet sand. I stepped into these enormous yet delicate feet. They dwarfed my own. I was standing in the bare footsteps of a god. As I looked ahead of me, I could see the vastness of the deity's stride into the temple. The left foot had been imprinted again a few metres inside the temple, this time on the entrance to the vestibule. 10 metres or so beyond that was the right footprint, inside the Holy of Holies, the innermost sanctum where the deity dwelt. The god had arrived home, and I was there to witness it. This was the grand residence of a deity whose precise identity has long since been forgotten. But although this god would fade from view, their bodily presence was clearly marked by those giant footprints travelling in just one direction, inside. There were no exiting footprints, no indication that the deity had left the temple. Rather, the footprints signalled the permanent presence of the god within. It's this sense of material presence that lies at the heart of ancient ideas about deities. The perceived reality of the gods was bound up with the notion that for anything or anyone to exist and persist is to be present and placed in some tangible form. It's to be engaged with and within the physical world. The footprints at Ayn Dara communicated precisely this sense of placement. They marked the exact place of the deity within the world of humans. At this spot, where the heavenly and earthly realms met, the god was manifest and accessible to worshippers. The deity took on a social life. The power of the footprint to communicate complex ideas about social presence says as much about what it is to be human as it does about what it is to be a god. When we see footprints, we recognize them as material traces of being, a frozen moment of movement or stillness, a memorial, however fleeting, to a reality by which we configure ourselves in the world and with those around us. Footprints capture something of the extraordinary and the familiar about human life, the orchestrated and the haphazard, the durable and the flimsy. A toddler's excited footsteps imprinted in sand or snow. Celebrity shoe prints set in concrete on Hollywood Boulevard. Muddy shoes accidentally tracked across a kitchen floor. The footprints of a group of Australopithecus afarensis, some of our earliest bipedal hominid ancestors, solidified in volcanic ash 3.5 million years ago in Laetoli, northern Tanzania. The famous dusty boot print of Apollo 11 astronaut Buzz Aldrin on the surface of the moon. A footprint isn't simply a trace or a representation of the foot. It's a material memory of its owner treading upon the surface on which the print appears, conjuring the presence of the whole body, the whole person. Our feet are not simply the pedestals on which we stand or the motors by which we move, but the foundations of our presence in the world. The impressions made by our feet have imprinted themselves into the religious cultures we've created. The footprints of gods and other extraordinary beings are celebrated and venerated all over the globe. Divine or mystical beings are said to have left their footprints in rock art across Scandinavian and British sites of the Late Bronze and Iron Ages. On an island sacred to the ancient Inca in Lake Titicaca, separating Bolivia from Peru, the footsteps of the sun god Inti are displayed. In southern Botswana, the giant hunter Metsing left his footprints in wet earth around a waterhole. The extent to which the footprint appears in the ritual settings of human communities across time and space is remarkable. Some of the earliest examples of divine footprints derive from the ancient sanctuaries of deities who once travelled the lands bordering the Mediterranean. According to Herodotus, the enormous footprint of Heracles could be seen in a rock by a river in Scythia, a print Lucian mockingly claimed to be bigger than the footprint of the god Dionysus next to it. The Egyptian goddess Isis left impressions of her feet across the Greco-Roman world. At Meronia in Greece, for example, her supersized prints appear alongside those of one of her consorts, Serapis. This divine couple is also invoked in a 1st century BCE inscription upon a marble slab in Thessaloniki, beneath which the goddess has approvingly left her footprints. Such is the power of divine footprints that they often became sites of competing religious claims. Most famous, perhaps, is the depression in rock akin to an enormous footprint on Sriapada, a high peak in south-central Sri Lanka. For Tamil Hindus, it's the print of Shiva, left as he danced creation into existence. For Buddhists, the footprint belongs to Gautama Buddha, who pressed his foot into a sapphire beneath the rock. For Muslims, it's the print left by Adam as he trod on the mountain following his expulsion from Eden. For Christians, it's the footprint of St. Thomas, who's claimed to have brought Christianity to the region. Jerusalem, too, has its share of contested divine footprints. As he ascended to heaven, Muhammad is said to have left a single footprint upon the exposed spur of bedrock enshrined beneath the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem. But for Christian pilgrims and crusaders of the medieval period, the footprint on this sacred rock belonged to Jesus, whose foot is also said to be imprinted on the Mount of Olives, where it's been venerated since at least the 5th century CE. Whether the work of geological erosion, local folklore, or ritual art, each of these footprints communicates something of both the earthiness and otherworldliness of a divine or holy being. As my own feet rested in the footprints of an ancient deity in Syria, I better understood why the biblical God is so frequently concerned with the placement of his feet, and why we find his footprints all over the Bible and the landscapes its texts describe. In Genesis, Adam and Eve hear Yahweh's footsteps approaching as he walks in the Garden of Eden. Later in the same book, Abraham sees Yahweh standing with two other divine beings beneath a group of sacred trees, and subsequently goes for a walk with him. Soon after, Abraham's grandson, Jacob, encounters Yahweh standing next to him in a sacred space at Bethel. In the book of Exodus, Moses meets God several times. When he first sees Yahweh in his corporeal form, the deity is standing on a magical rock in the wilderness. Later, when Moses ascends Mount Sinai with a group of tribal elders, God is seen again, along with a stunning close-up of the heavenly floor on which his feet rest. Moses and Aaron, Nadav and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel went up, and they saw the God of Israel, and under his feet there was something like a brick pavement of lapis lazuli, like the very heavens for clarity. When the biblical story moves to Jerusalem, God's feet are there too. This time, they're surrounded by the fragrant trees of an Eden-like temple garden, which, Yahweh says, glorify where my feet rest. This is the place for the soles of my feet, where I'll reside among the people of Israel forever, he declares of his temple in the city. It is the place to which generations of his worshippers would flock to encounter the presence of the divine. In the Bible, God's feet are crucial to his social existence, fundamental to his very being, and so they're the bodily features by which he often renders himself evident in the world. The force of his feet splits mountains. They shake the earth as he strides out from the desert. They crush the bodies of his enemies. They transform dust and dirt into holy ground. Like indelible tracks worn into the earth along ancient pathways, the precise locations at which Yahweh plants his feet impact the landscape. His sure-footed presence in the earthly realm transforms a piece of ground into a place, and a place into sacred space. Almost 4 million years ago, three changes in the bodies of our primeval ancestors enabled us to climb down from the trees to live upon the ground. Our brains grew larger and more powerful. Our thumbs and fingers became more dexterous. Our spines, hips, and legs changed shape and alignment so that we could habitually walk upright on 2 feet. In the popular drama of human evolution, our brains and hands tend to play the starring roles, with the feet cast as supporting members of the anatomical ensemble. According to the usual script, habitual human bipedalism freed up the hands so that they could spend less time propelling our bodies about and more time working with the brain in carrying out increasingly complex tasks. It was with our hands and our heads that human animals conquered the world. Our feet simply got us about. And yet, as the social anthropologist Tim Ingold argues, the relegation of our feet to mere motors was not simply a product of evolution. It was also a head-over-heels conceptual shift in European intellectual perception millions of years later, brought about by the dominance of the stiff leather boot. With the invention of the boot came the enclosing of the foot, dulling its sensory capacities, limiting its use as a tool to grasp and manipulate objects, and distancing our feet from the ground. The pervasive presence of the booted foot altered Europeans' bodily experience of the natural world, so much so that by the time human evolutionary theory had become firmly established in the modern West, the boot was already a colonial and cultural marker of civilization, along with chairs, pavements, military parade grounds, and motorized vehicles, all of which elevated us away from the earthy messiness of the primitive, uncontrollable world. But as our feet lost touch with the ground, so we lost touch with our feet. By contrast, our religious ancestors were far more grounded, and so too were their gods. The deities of the ancient Levant kept their feet firmly planted on the earth, imparting something of the divine to the places at which they stood. Indeed, sacred space had long been marked by the material presence of supernatural powers. Across the Levant, for thousands of years before Yahweh worship emerged, the presence of these supernatural powers was often manifested by standing stones. Heavyweight, hardy and enduring, and taller than they were wide, these roughly hewn stone slabs ranged in size from just a foot or so high to towering monoliths. They were erected into standing position, singly or in small groups, at places of power in the landscape, locations deemed to mark magical points of access to other realms. Their upright stance transformed the natural stone into a social presence. The stone stood up like a person. By the early Bronze Age, circa 3100 to 2000 BCE, standing stones could be found in a range of settings, at isolated, open-air locations at a distance from human communities, at outdoor locations on the outskirts of walled settlements, and inside buildings or compounds within settlements. Archaeologists are still uncertain about the precise ways in which these stones were understood to function during this period. What's more certain, however, is that by the Middle Bronze Age, circa 2000 to 1500 BCE, standing stones were identified with extraordinary beings. They marked the presence of deities, deified ancestors, and other supernatural powers who stood at places at which the membrane between the human realm and otherworldly planes was at its most permeable. The identification of standing stones with a divine presence continued throughout the Late Bronze Age, circa 1550 to 1200 BCE, and the Iron Age, from about 1200 to 539 BCE. During this long period, these stones were common, although not uniform, features of temples and other ritual spaces across the southern Levant. Whether these sacred sites were sited inside towns and cities, on their fringes, or at more remote locations in the wider landscape, their standing stones simultaneously monumentalised, memorialised, and manifested the robust, grounded presence of the divine. Over thousands of years, the sturdy base of a standing stone implanted into the earth had gradually come to mark the presence of a deity or otherworldly being dwelling in the material world. And these very ancient ideas about divine presence played a crucial role in shaping the God of the Bible and the places at which he stood. Standing stones populated the urban temples and outdoor sanctuaries associated with Yahweh worship, as archaeological excavations confirm. Some of these were very ancient, as at early Iron Age Shechem near modern Nablus in the West Bank. Here, three stones had already stood for several centuries in a large fortified cult place. Although it's now broken, the largest of these is estimated to have been almost 3 metres high. Others were more recent installations. Within a Judahite fortress at Arad in the Negev Desert, an 8th century BCE temple dedicated to Yahweh contained a standing stone almost a metre tall, originally decorated with red pigment. At the same time, a sanctuary just inside the city of Dan, in the very north of the neighbouring Kingdom of Israel, contained several groups of standing stones, some accompanied by incense burners and the bones of sacrificial animals. These sites represent just a handful of those exhibiting standing stones in their cult places, demonstrating that they were a familiar presence across the religious landscape. Today, these stones might look unexpectedly modest, even a little undignified, for time has stripped them of all but the barest traces of their social lives. But something of their sacred presence and numinous power can be seen on two coins from the Phoenician cities of Tyre and Byblos, in what's now Lebanon. Although these coins were minted in the Roman period, both exhibit far older Levantine religious motifs. One shows a standing stone enshrined within a high-status temple courtyard. The other depicts a pair of standing stones beneath a sacred tree, an offering of incense burning on an ornate brazier before them. Given their ubiquity across the Levant, it's no surprise to find that the biblical writers were well acquainted with standing stones. More significantly, the terminology they used to refer to these objects and their cult places reflects the age-old association of the standing presence of the divine and sacred space. In the Hebrew Bible, a standing stone is called a matzeva, derived from the word meaning standing, while a sacred location at which these stones were placed is called a makom, a term commonly translated place, but which more precisely means a standing place. This specialised religious terminology is artfully employed in a highly idealised account in Genesis about the supposed origins of a temple at Bethel, a sacred site located atop a small mountain within the wider environs of what is now Ramallah in the West Bank. Dating to at least the Middle Bronze Age, the site's biblical name betrays its very ancient and prestigious origins. Bethel tends to be translated as House of God, but it more literally means House of Ale, suggesting it was a temple originally sacred to Yahweh's predecessor. As with many other religious sites and stories, however, it was later claimed by Yahweh worshippers as their own, giving rise to a legend in Genesis in which the temple is founded by one of the great ancestors of Israel, Jacob. As he travels through the promised land of Canaan on a quest for a wife, Jacob beds down for the night in the open, using a slab of stone as a large pillow. He dreams and sees a staircase, not a ladder, on which messenger gods are travelling up and down between the earth and the heavens, a clear indication that this is a place at which humans can access the divine. Suddenly, Yahweh is standing next to him. He introduces himself as the ancestral deity of Jacob's forebears, Abraham and Isaac, and promises blessings of perpetual fertility and immovable territory in return for allegiance from Jacob and his descendants. When he awakes, Jacob realizes he's been sleeping in the dwelling place of the deity. "Yahweh is in the standing place," he exclaims, giddy with the tremulous zeal of the newly converted. "How awesome is this standing place!" He sets up the rock on which he slept as a standing stone, Matzeva, anoints it with sacred oil, and pledges to make offerings to Yahweh there. At Bethel, Yahweh not only stands in the place marked by a standing stone, but identifies with the stone itself. "I am the God of Bethel, whom you anointed there in the Matzeva," he later reminds Jacob. Today, the ancient temple at Bethel is lost to pilgrims, tourists, and archaeologists, for much of the ancient city lies hidden beneath the long-established West Bank town of Beitin, one of many towns and villages caught up in bitter territorial disputes between primarily Orthodox Jewish settlers and local Palestinian communities. But ancient Bethel was long known to have been one of the most authoritative and prosperous religious sites in the region throughout the Iron Age and well into the Roman period. Consequently, its temple was also a fierce competitor to its near neighbour in Jerusalem. Only a little over 10 miles apart, the temples in Bethel and Jerusalem were powerful political and economic hubs located in related but rival territories during the first half of the first millennium BCE. Bethel, in the punchy Kingdom of Israel and later the Assyrian province of Samarina, was a sanctuary of prestigious ancestral pedigree under the administrative patronage of the state, while Jerusalem, of course, was the capital of the smaller, weaker Kingdom of Judah, and its temple served as the ritual powerhouse of the ruling Davidic dynasty. As high-status political and economic centres, as well as important cult places, Bethel and Jerusalem each relied on Yahweh's footfall to maintain their position as the powerful and profitable place at which the deity was present. Bethel might have boasted of being the standing place of God, but Jerusalem counted with the claim it was the place at which God had chosen to permanently rest his feet. It was a claim reflected in Yahweh's biblical assertions that the Jerusalem temple was my sanctuary, the place of my feet, and the place for the soles of my feet where I'll reside forever. But these were not expressions of quiet, restful domesticity. They were proprietorial. Whether divine or human, feet communicated ownership and identity throughout ancient Southwest Asia. And the God of the Bible used his to stamp his authoritative presence onto the world of his worshippers. Underfoot. In a world in which writing tended to be the preserve of scribal guilds, religious specialists, and the elites for whom they worked, cylinder seals, stamp seals, tokens, and amulets were frequently used as markers of identity, functioning in ways not dissimilar to our own personal signatures, PIN numbers, and fingerprints today. For wealthier members of society, small stone or bone seals, comprising images or a few words, were pressed or rolled into wet clay to validate legal documents and movable property, such as storage jars of wine, olives, and grain. Whether prosperous or poor, however, people's clothing, sandals, or body parts also served a similar function. Clay tablets from the late Bronze Mesopotamian town of Nuzi in the northern reaches of modern-day Iraq illustrate the ways in which children's footprints were used as items of identity and exchange. Dated to between 1500 and 1350 BCE, some of them are imprinted with the feet of ownerless children, foundlings and orphans, alongside a record of their newly assigned parents, marking the adoptive family's responsibility for the child and the child's new social identity. At about the same time in Emar, a city on the upper Euphrates in what's now Syria, the young children of impoverished families might also have been pawned or sold into servitude or given over to local businesses by means of a similar process. Records from Imar reveal this is precisely what a woman called Kuei and her husband Sadama had to do. Unable to feed their family, they sold their 2-year-old daughter, year-old twin boys, and a baby girl to a religious specialist called Baal Malik, who paid a mere 60 shekels for the children and later appears to have trained the two boys to be diviners. Clay tablets recording the sale are accompanied by further tablets, each impressed with the child's footprint and a record of their name, serving as contracts of receipt for Baal Malik. These children's feet quite literally marked their new social identities. Property sales, too, might also be accomplished by means of the foot. In several Mesopotamian cities, tracts of land were transferred in a series of legal rituals which included references to the seller raising a foot from the parcel of land to be released and the buyer setting a foot on the land to claim its new ownership. Similar practices are reflected in the Bible, in which land is taken by walking upon it or transferred to another by the seller removing a sandal and symbolically giving it to the buyer. In some traditions, a dead man's land and the womb of his widow might be contracted or released by his kinsmen by means of similar sandal rituals conveying his social and legal right to claim ownership and occupancy of his dead kinsman's property. These body rituals underlie the dominant territorial ideologies of the Bible, in which God vows to give the land of Canaan to the Israelites. In Deuteronomy, Yahweh promises the Israelites that every place where the soles of your feet tread will be yours. In Genesis, he commands Abraham to walk through the length and breadth of the land of Canaan, for I will give it to you. The proprietorial function of Abraham's striding feet is a function shared with a divine figure properly known as the Satan or the Accuser, God's minister of justice in the book of Job, whose task it is to go to and fro on the earth and to walk up and down upon it, policing its inhabitants and punishing those unfaithful to God. In each of these verses, the biblical writers are deliberately engaging in the rhetoric and performance of political power, all prosecuted via the feet. For thousands of years, from the early 3rd millennium BCE and continuing into the Roman era, the acquisition of lands by means of conquest was regularly publicised in royal inscriptions across Southwest Asia and the Eastern Mediterranean, describing a king setting his foot or bringing down his sandals on vanquished territories and their peoples. It's an idea beautifully illustrated on the inner soles of King Tutankhamun's ceremonial sandals, which are decorated with gold-lined images of the trussed-up bodies of foreign enemies upon which he trod. Like the pharaoh, the biblical god also used his sandals to mark the subjugation of an enemy. On Edom I hurl my shoe, he boasts in the Psalms, refocusing what might appear to westernize as a divine temper tantrum into a violent act of territorial expansion into a neighbouring nation. Yahweh's shoes were not as ornate as Tutankhamun's, but they were no less authoritative. Cult images of southern Levantine gods suggest they usually wore delicate leather sandals not dissimilar to flip-flops. They might have been relatively simple in style, but the gods' shoes were sandals of status. Unlike the fibrous or leather sandals worn by mere mortals, the purpose of divine shoes was not to protect the feet, but to highlight a deity's sure-footed power. The ideological rather than practical purpose of divine footwear is evident in a small statue of one of Yahweh's immediate cultural predecessors, a high god from 14th century BCE Hatsor, in what is today modern Israel. Seated in ceremonial glory on a now missing throne, the deity wears sandals accessorized with snazzy wedged heels, giving him an additional authoritative lift. Wedge sandals like these would also become the power shoes of choice for both the fearsome kings of the late Assyrian Empire and the divine beings who protected their thrones. In the British Museum, traces of pigments on the 9th century BCE wall panels of a royal palace at Kalhu, better known as Nimrud, vividly attest to their force. Accessorized with blood-red soles, they were shoes of deadly dominion. Across ancient Southwest Asia, the divinely derived power of royal feet had long been exhibited on iconographic monuments displayed in temples, palaces, and even on mountainsides, showing the successful king trampling the landscapes and bodies of the subjugated. One of the most dynamic examples is the victory stela of the formidable Mesopotamian king Naram-Sin, circa 2254 to 2218 BCE, grandson of the world's first emperor, Sargon of Akkad. Now in the Louvre, it was originally set up in the city of Sippar, in what is today Iraq, and is dated to about 2250 BCE. It monumentalises Naram-Sin's defeat of a powerful people called the Lulubi, who dwelt in the eastern foothills of the Zagros Mountains. Naram-Sin is depicted as a triumphant, muscular monarch, striding up a steep, rocky landscape towards the god's sacred mountain, above which the starburst emblems of the high gods glitter. As he ascends, his eyes fixed on the peak of the divine mountain, the heavens, he pins the broken bodies of his barefooted enemies under his sandaled feet, his obedient troops marching in file below him. Naram-Sin is thought to have been one of the first Mesopotamian kings to declare himself divine, and the iconography of this stela vividly promotes his deification. Godlike in stature, he dwarfs both his soldiers and enemies as he ascends from the earthly realm into the heavenly plane. Wearing the horned crown of the gods as he tramples the world into submission, he has become just like one of the deities who brought order to the universe by subduing the forces of chaos and disruption under their feet. The subjugation of chaos was one of the most widespread mythological themes of ancient Southwest Asian religions. The creation of the world was frequently understood to have been the result of a divine battle against chaos, often personified as a gigantic and primordial seven-headed sea monster. Although the myth varied in its details across Southwest Asian civilizations, its basic shape was the same. A fearless young warrior deity takes on the monster in hand-to-hand combat, each using an arsenal of cosmic forces and magical weapons to attempt to defeat the other. After a lengthy and brutal struggle, the monster is vanquished, the victorious deity trampling its body in an assertion of supremacy. In some traditions, the god then dismembers and rearranges the corpse, creating a carefully contained watery roof for the skies, which separates the heavenly realm from the earthly realm, and an aqueous cosmic floor to separate the earth from the underworld. Having imposed order upon chaos, the warrior deity is rewarded with kingship over the gods and his own temple. The best-known example of this mythic trope is found in the Babylonian epic Enuma Elish, a masterpiece of the late 2nd millennium BCE, in which the mighty god Marduk defeats the fearsome Tiamat, the ancient mother of the gods and embodiment of the primeval sea. Its vivid celebration of Marduk's victory displays the cosmic power of the god's trampling feet. He flung down her carcass, he took his stand upon it. The lord trampled upon the frame of Tiamat. With his merciless mace he crushed her skull. He cut open the arteries of her blood. He split her in two like a fish for drying. Half of her he set up and made as a cover, heaven. He stretched out the hide and assigned watchmen and ordered them not to let her waters escape. In the Bible, the battle is fought between Yahweh and the aqueous chaos monster, whose various names attest to its dangerously disordered, unbounded nature. Leviathan, twisty one. Rahav, overflow. Yam, sea. Nahar, river flood. Tanin, dragon or sea monster. And Tehom, deep. Many of which are the same names given to Baal's watery arch enemy in the older Ugaritic myths of the battle with disorder. In several biblical texts, Yahweh is praised for driving back Yam, breaking the heads of the sea monsters, piercing Rahav, smashing the heads of Leviathan, dismembering and cutting openings in the corpse of chaos for springs and torrents. According to the Book of Job, this enormous watery monster has scaly skin akin to rows of tightly packed shields. Flames shoot from its mouth, scorching smoke pours forth from its nostrils, and when it sneezes, it flashes lightning. As it thrashes about and roars in might, the dragon makes its primal waters boil, whipping up a foam so thick it looks white-haired. It terrifies even the other deities in Yahweh's retinue. Are not even the gods overwhelmed at the sight of it? Yahweh asks. No one is so fierce as to dare stir it up. Who can stand before it? Who can confront it and be safe under the whole heaven? Who? The answer to these questions, of course, is Yahweh, who subjugates the chaos monster by hooking it like a fish, filleting its body and trampling it under his feet. Elsewhere in the Hebrew Bible, God follows up his victory over the monster by pinning its watery body beneath his throne in his temple in Jerusalem. Yahweh sits enthroned over the flood. Yahweh sits enthroned as king forever, went the ancient ritual refrain. Here, temple mythology dovetailed with a distinctly royal ideology. Yahweh was explicitly cast as a divine king, seated in glory in a throne room in his temple. The fearsome chaos monster, now his subservient prisoner, its waters compelled to roar a hymn of praise to Yahweh's superior might. Yahweh is king, he is robed in majesty. Yahweh is robed, he's girded with strength. He's established the world, it shall never be moved. Your throne is established from old, you are from everlasting. The river floods have lifted up, O Yahweh, the river floods have lifted up their voice. The river floods lift up their roaring. More majestic than the thunders of mighty waters, more majestic than the waves of the sea, majestic on high is Yahweh. Echoes of the divine defeat of chaos reverberate throughout the Bible as the mythic trampling, dissection, and abuse of its watery form is recycled in other texts. In Exodus, Yahweh bisects the sea to enable Moses and the Israelites to escape Egypt. In the Gospels, Jesus walks like a god on raging waters. And in the book of Revelation, the archangel Michael battles a seven-headed dragon in the final apocalypse. Adopting and adapting the mythic motif of God's battle with monstrous chaos, these traditions demonstrate just how pervasive the ancient myth continued to be. Picking up motifs drawn from the Greek myth of Bellerophon's slaying of the Chimera, it would later find its way into the popular legend of St. George and the Dragon, and become a stock image of hellish turmoil in the wall paintings, tapestries, and illuminated manuscripts of medieval Europe. But in the Hebrew Bible, the only proper place for chaos was beneath the feet of the deity enthroned in his temple in Jerusalem. The building itself was located on the deity's holy mountain, Zion, where the vast elevated plaza, known in Jewish tradition as Har HaBayit, Temple Mount, and in Islamic tradition as Haram al-Sharif, Noble Sanctuary, stands today. Even in the Iron Age, Zion was less a mountain and rather more a hill. But within the bounds of sacred topography, the temple's lofty location was mythic rather than strictly geological. To step into any temple was to ascend into the heavenly sphere, the world of the gods, located in the skies atop a gigantic mythological mountain at the centre of the world. Rooted in the underworld, stretching up through the earthly realm and reaching into the heavens, this cosmic mountain was the vertical axis of the universe. It was commonly known in mythological and ritual texts across the Levant as the Holy Mountain, or the Mountain of the Gods, or the Mount of Assembly, and was the site at which the gods gathered to feast, hold council meetings to debate the day-to-day running of the cosmos, and to enjoy the attentions of their worshippers. Whether sited on a mountain, a hill, a rocky outcrop, or even a raised artificial platform, in the imagined realities of ancient Levantine religions, a temple was necessarily and schematically located at the apex of the cosmic mountain. It's for this reason that the God of the Bible, like his contemporaries across the sea on Mount Olympus, is often encountered on mountaintops. Be it Sinai or Horeb in the wilderness, Carmel, Tabor, Ebal or Gerizim in the highlands, or Zion or the Mount of Olives in Jerusalem, divine presence is particularly associated with high points in the landscape and the mythological motif of the cosmic mountain. It's an idea beautifully expressed in a small poetic fragment embedded in the Book of Amos, in which Yahweh's footsteps on the mountaintops demonstrate his dominion and his role as guarantor of cosmic order. For look, the one who forms the mountains, creates the wind, reveals his plan to mortals, makes the morning darkness, and treads on the heights of the earth. Yahweh, God of hosts, is his name. As a king enthroned on the cosmic mountain, Yahweh enjoyed the affectations of ancient princely rule typical of many other deities across Southwest Asia, including a permanent dwelling place of impressive quality. A high-status urban construction, sponsored by the local king and reflecting the religious worldviews of social elites, the Jerusalem temple had much in common with other Levantine temples of the 2nd and 1st millennia BCE. Constructed of large stone blocks and sweet-smelling cedar, a favourite fragrance of many deities, temples were power structures for both humans and gods. Most were set on a large raised terrace, accessed by steps, and separated from the ordinary world by a walled precinct into which gateways were cut. These gates opened onto an open-air courtyard where animal sacrifices and other communal and potentially messy rituals were performed. In larger temples, courtyards might also contain sacred trees and plants, pens to hold sacrificial animals, and small workshops where specialised temple crafts such as pottery, weaving, and herb processing were carried out. Most Levantine temples were rectangular in shape and accessed at the short eastern side by more ascending steps, a twinned pillared porch, and a large set of doors, which might be plated with bronze or other shiny materials to manifest the gleaming brightness of the heavenly realm. These gave entry to a large enclosed space, roofed with wooden beams and centred with incense and perfumed oils, within which more exclusive and now mostly unknown rituals were performed. In this space, usually at the very back of the building, behind a wall or screen, was an elevated chamber, the inner sanctum, known in the Bible as the Holy of Holies, where the deity's statue, standing stone or symbol was housed. Throughout the temple complex, including within the building itself, the walls and portals were covered with magical protective symbols of cosmic fecundity. In the Jerusalem temple, these seem to have included sacred palm trees, pomegranates, rosettes, and blossoming flowers, as well as images of lions, bulls, and other powerful guardian beings. It was a place of intense multi-sensory stimulation for those privileged enough to enter. The monumentality and iconography of temple architecture served not only to glorify their human commissioners and the deities they honoured, but vividly demonstrated the imposition of the divinely inspired human-built environment upon unwieldy, uncultivated, uncivilized chaos. But the most important function of a royal temple was as a ritual space at which the presence of deities was not only marked, but maintained. And deities were very high maintenance. Their residences were not simply dwelling places, but divine palaces. The incumbent deity and their assembly of junior gods was attended by a household of servants comprising the temple priesthood, who prepared and served the deity's meals, sacrifices and libations, diviners, prophets and cultic scribes who smoothed the transmission of divine communication, speaking, interpreting and recording oracles, gnomons, and other priests and ritual functionaries who washed, dressed and paraded the gods in the form of cult statues. Ideologically, if not literally, these temples might include enormous furniture for their supersized deities. In an ancient world in which big was beautiful, the gigantism of the gods and their temple furnishings was both an aesthetic delight and a theological virtue. It's for this reason that in the biblical portrayal of the Jerusalem temple, which in its details speaks more to the rhetoric of political prestige than historical reality, King Solomon is said to have provided Yahweh with enormous household furniture, attesting to the gigantic proportions of his body. These included a huge bronze altar for sacrificial meals, measuring over 32 feet or 20 cubits in length and breadth, and more than 16 feet or 10 cubits high, a vast water basin over 16 feet in diameter, 10 cubits, and ritual bowls for the gods' oils and perfumes, set on stands more than 11 feet high or 7 cubits. But the most important pieces of furniture could be found in the temple's Holy of Holies. Here, two golden cherubim formed the giant throne on which Yahweh was said to sit. Far from being the winged, chubby babies of Renaissance art, cherubim were frightening divine beings with the wings of an eagle, the body of a lion, a bull, or a person, and a human-like face. Equipped with speed, strength, and steadfast stubbornness, they served the gods as guardians and could usually be found supporting the thrones of high gods and their nominated kings, and standing at the thresholds of temples. The Jerusalem cherubim are said to have stood a staggering 16 feet high, matching their equally enormous wingspan of 16 feet, 10 cubits by 10 cubits. Enthroned upon them, Yahweh's feet rested on the Ark of the Covenant, a box-shaped miniature shrine cast as a golden pedestal said to measure 4 feet long, 2.5 cubits, and described in the Book of Chronicles as the footstool of our God. The symbolic significance of this configuration of divine furniture is attested by its longevity and ubiquity in the religious art of the ancient Levant. Royal gods and goddesses are commonly depicted sitting upon tall, ornate thrones in their temples, their feet resting neatly upon raised, solid-legged, square footstools. When the God of the Bible had declared the Jerusalem temple to be the place for the soles of his feet, he meant it literally, and his worshippers knew it too. Yahweh is king, let the peoples tremble. He sits enthroned upon the cherubim, let the earth quake. Yahweh is huge in Zion, he's exalted over all the peoples. Extol Yahweh our God, worship at his footstool, holy is he. Like the deity at Ein Dara in Syria, whose footprints were set in stone as they strode into their temple, the permanence of Yahweh's presence in the Jerusalem temple was made manifest by his feet. Enthroned in exalted glory, this was a deity exuding the confident, stable control of a cosmic king who had little need to rise from his seat, a powerful ruler who could sit and relax, his feet up on his stool, the forces of rebellion quashed under the soles of his shoes. That, at least, was the theological ideal. The religious reality was rather different. The political power play of God's immortals would gradually come to loosen Yahweh's feet from their place in Zion, and worshippers would find themselves reminded that their deity was neither immovable nor immobile.